All righty, we will now begin our third and final panel. Thanks for everybody for being here. We will get to our distinguished panelists, but first I am going to introduce the moderator, John Hood. John is the president of the John William Pope Foundation. He is serves on the board at the John Locke Foundation, where he champions the E.A. Morris program, which is a great fellowship program for young professionals who are interested in leadership. I would definitely recommend that. John is a distinguished NC journalist in politics, and he's a nonfiction writer of books. And as of late, he has taken his hand to fiction writing. You can find his book called Mountain Folk, which I describe as the genre of first principles fantasy. So without further ado, please welcome John Hood to the stage.
Thank you all very much for being here. Some would say I've always been writing fiction and fantasy. All right. So I want to thank you all for being here and for this important event. I want to thank the North Carolina Lawyer Chapters of the Federalist Society for putting this event together and for asking me to moderate it. It's so very important that we spotlight and showcase our judicial races here in North Carolina. In 2022, we will be choosing two members of the North Carolina Supreme Court. Of course, we'll be talking about that today, and also four members of the Court of Appeals. I'm delighted that all four candidates for our two Supreme Court races are joining us. Candidates, thank you very much. And audience, thank you so much for signaling how important you believe this to be. I know you all, of course, know that we elect our appellate judges, but many North Carolinians don't know that. So it's important for all of us to encourage our friends and our family members to do their homework, to notice that there are other races on the ballot, and to be prepared for that. My mission as moderator today is to give voters more information about who the candidates are, what views or philosophies may drive their decisions. We'll do our best to leave time for questions from the audience in a little while, and to that point, you will find some cards on your table. So if you have a question or a question occurs to you over the course of our conversation, please write the card, write it on the card, and how are we going to collect them? People will mysteriously take the cards from your hand. You won't even know it. They're law students. They're like secret agents. Here's how the forum's going to work. Each candidate will have an opening statement of 1 minute. Then I will be posing a set of questions to the candidates. We'll have about 10 minutes for each of the two races for the candidates to answer questions from me. Then we will pose questions from the audience. And then finally, there will be an opportunity for each of our candidates to present 2 minutes of closing thoughts. So let's go ahead and get started with opening remarks. And let us begin with Judge Lucy Inman. She's the Democratic candidate for Associate Justice, Seat 3 on the court. Judge Inman, welcome.
Thank you so much, John, and thank you to the Federalist Society for hosting this forum. My name is Lucy Inman. My first experience in a courtroom was as a newspaper reporter. I soon realized in that job that courts are where individuals meet their government on a daily basis, and I wanted to participate in the justice system. So I went to law school, and after clerking for 2 years at the North Carolina Supreme Court, I practiced civil litigation for 18 years. And then I served for 4 years as a Superior Court judge all across North Carolina. In 2014, I was elected in a statewide nonpartisan election to the North Carolina Court of Appeals, and I'm in my 8th year there. I'm running for the Supreme Court to continue my state service and to protect our Supreme Court from partisan politics that threatens the independence of each justice and the court itself. I look forward to answering your questions. And thank you for having me.
Next is Judge Richard Dietz. He is the Republican candidate for Associate Justice, Seat 3.
Good evening, everyone, and thank you to the Federalist Society for organizing this forum. So I'm Richard Dietz, and it's been a privilege to have served for 8 years on the Court of Appeals, and now I'm running for the open seat on the Supreme Court. And I've made the theme of my campaign leadership for the courts, and I'll tell you what that means. So I think first, leadership means having the skills to do the work of a Supreme Court justice. And as many of you know, I spent my entire legal career in what they call issues and appeals, so the kinds of complex, groundbreaking cases that are the ones that go to the Supreme Court. But as I think you'll hear more during this forum, I think leadership is more than that. Leadership also means being able to show the public that judges are public servants, not politicians, reinforce that idea of judicial independence. And then I think importantly, leadership is about going beyond the courtroom and seeing what judges can do to help educate the public and help improve access to courts. And as I hope as I talk to you tonight, you're going to hear more about that and get excited to watch me join our state's highest court in the November election. So thank you all again.
Thank you, Judge Dietz. Next is Trey Allen. He is the Republican candidate for seat 5 on the North Carolina Supreme Court.
Good evening, everyone. I am Trey Allen. Thanks so much to the Federalist Society for hosting this event. I currently serve as the general counsel for our state's court system. In that role, I give legal guidance to court officials around the state. I'm on leave from the UNC Chapel Hill School of Government, where I'm a tenured professor who focuses on various aspects of local government law. Before that, I practiced law and was a partner at a Raleigh law firm where I litigated constitutional law claims and other civil claims in state court and federal court at the trial level and at the appellate level. Before that, I had the honor of clerking for a state Supreme Court justice. He was the newbie on the court at that time. He's now your Chief Justice. I began my legal career in the United States Marine Corps, serving 4.5 years. Most of that was overseas. I did do a tour of duty in Iraq. I'm running to bolster the public's faith in our courts as institutions that make decisions even in and especially in the important cases based on law, not politics. If I'm elected to the North Carolina Supreme Court, that's exactly what I'll do my best to do. Thank you.
Next is Justice Sam Ervin IV. He is the Democratic candidate and the incumbent for seat 5.
Thank you, John, and thanks to the members of the Federalist Society. I've always enjoyed coming to these gatherings in the past. It's good to see so many folks here, and I hope that you'll learn something about the candidates tonight. I've been in the court system now for almost 40 years in some capacity or other. I think probably I'm as known a quantity as you're likely to find. I'm a native of Morganton in the western end of the state. I still live there. I'm a product of the public schools in Burke County, graduated from Davidson College, magna cum laude, then graduated from Harvard Law School, cum laude, in 1981, practiced law in Morganton for almost 18 years doing a general civil and criminal and administrative trial practice, and also did a lot of appellate work before the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals. In 1999, I became a member of the North Carolina Utilities Commission, which is a quasi-judicial body that functions very much like a court, served on that body for almost 10 years, then was elected to the Court of Appeals in 2008, had the privilege of serving on that body for 6 years before being elected to the Supreme Court in 2015. It's been the privilege of my life to serve on the Supreme Court. Very few people get the opportunity to do that. And I think the job of an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court is pretty simple. We decide specific cases. Our job is to take the facts of the case, which are mostly developed in the trial court, and apply the law as we see it to those facts in an attempt to produce a judgment that's fair, that's impartial, that treats everybody equally under the law, and that does not stem from some sort of political or ideological agenda. I've got a record, I think, of doing exactly what I say should be done, and I appreciate the chance to talk about that and other subjects this evening. Thank you very much, John.
Now we're going to proceed to our panels. The way we're going to do this is we're going to have Judge Inman and Judge Dietz answer some questions together, and then our other two candidates answer questions together later. Some of the questions may be similar, some may be not. We'll see what whim strikes me. Now, keep in mind, this is a conversation, so feel free to add in, agree. You can, in fact, agree on things. It's shocking but true, but also feel free to disagree. I'll try to keep the speaking times roughly balanced. Here we go. So the first question. Section 35 of the Declaration of Rights in the North Carolina Constitution states, a frequent recurrence to fundamental principles is absolutely necessary to preserve the blessings of liberty. This is a question for both candidates. What does that statement mean to you? Let's start with Judge Inman.
Sure. Well, a frequent recurrent to fundamental principles means to me. Oh, sorry. Thank you. All this year, all this time in a pandemic, and I still don't know how to unmute myself. I'm so sorry. What that means to me is there are fundamental principles that we have to keep in mind and we return to whenever we consider any case. That's the basis for the consistency of a court's opinions. And I don't mean a consistency in result. I mean a consistency in methodology. That goes to me to canons of interpretation. It goes to the fundamental principles that are provided in our state constitution. And remaining true to those in every case, going back to those in every case, whether it's a driving while impaired case or a multi-million dollar business dispute.
Judge Dietz, what does that phrase mean to you?
So is that, I think the folks who are in this room heard in an earlier panel, I just finished a paper about the state constitution, and I actually looked into this provision. I think it's really wonderful that what that means is this was the framers of our state constitution who were inspired by the principles of the Enlightenment, reminding us that we should return over and over to those ideas of the Enlightenment that are the foundation of the liberties that we have here in North Carolina. So these are ideas like rational thinking and open discourse and debate, the things that we're trained as lawyers that are so important and that I also think are important for society at large. So I think there's a lesson in our state constitution, an inspirational one, even in divisive times like we have today, about how important it is to hearken back to those ideas that were sort of at the founding of our nation, the idea that we can get together, have that debate, have that open discourse, that we can enjoy free speech, and that we can let the marketplace of ideas, let the good ideas rise to the top, you know, that we can come together as a society and reach a consensus. And I also think it's useful to keep that in mind as judges, because one of the things that's so important about our job as judges is that we have to be able to see all sides of everything. I think it can be challenging for some people to understand how important that is for us as judges, but we set aside all of our personal preferences and views, and we listen to every argument and weigh them and see which argument is the one that should prevail. And so again, I think in that provision sort of can be inspiration for judges about the role that we are doing as Enlightenment thinkers about understanding all of those different perspectives.
All right, next question, we'll start with Judge Dietz this time. Do you believe it's appropriate to use legislative history or evidence about the purpose of a statute in order to interpret the statute? Or do you believe the meaning of the statute should be determined based on its words and phrases without a regard to attempt to divine the purpose of it? Do you think these modes of interpretation give appellate judges room to lean on their policy preferences in interpreting the statute?
Yeah, so if you read my opinions, you'll see that I've certainly fallen on the side of believing that when we look at laws, what we need to do is look at the words that are chosen by lawmakers. And the way that I explain it, I teach a course over the summer, an appellate seminar to law students, and I talk to them about the ways that judges can interpret statutes. And what I explain to them is that sometimes you may look at a written law and say, wow, there seems to be a loophole in here. You know, I can see what the legislature must have been trying to accomplish, but if you read the law, there's a loophole that means people can do something else, and the law's not working. And it's easy to get misled into this idea that, well, lawmakers, legislators are angels, and they could only have been intending to, you know, have some wonderful policy when they enact it. And we forget that sometimes in order to have the votes to make a law, the law might not be perfect. And our job as judges is to enforce the law as it's written and not to try to imagine, oh, if, you know, if the lawmakers were trying to achieve something else, let's find a way to read these words to make that work. So I'll occasionally look at legislative history to sort of see what was going on in this law. But when I interpret the law, I look to the text because that's, I think, our obligation as judges is to see what the law says, what the words that are written in the law say, and it's up to the lawmakers to be the ones to write a law that's clear. And if it's ambiguous, if we can't understand that, then we need to tell the lawmakers, you need to go back and do a better job writing that law.
Judge Inman.
You know, we agree with each other on a few things, and this is one of them. I'll say it in the way I see it, and that is, to me, every interpretation of a statute begins with the text of the statute. And if you're looking at a subsection of the statute, it begins with that subsection. And if the words in that law that you're looking at are clear, there is absolutely no reason to look anywhere else, including legislative history, in my view. Of course, sometimes a phrase or a word that is absolutely clear to one judge is absolutely clear to another judge, and it means something different. That's when we have the harder cases. I think the next place I look is to the words and the phrases in the surrounding sections. You still stay within this text of what the legislature wrote in order to honor what the legislature has written. I think that legislative history, you know, may be interesting, but I think it can also be dangerous to read legislative history in the sense that, you know, we go through many drafts as judges of opinions, but it's only the final opinion that is what the court has written. And I think that legislative history, like other extrinsic sources, you have to really be careful in looking at that to think that you can discern what the legislature intended.
Well, just to play devil's advocate, not that I've ever done that before, isn't it possible if you had a statute that was written long ago, not 5 years ago or 10 years ago, but 50 years ago, 100 years ago, that the words and phrases used had a different meaning to them than it might be to us? And so if you're just focusing on the text and not on the context in which some of that text was chosen, then you might end up misinterpreting the statute because the language we use today is different from the way we've used the same English language like 100 years ago.
I think there's a burden on legislators, and it's not a light burden, to be very careful in writing the law and thinking about how it's going to be applied. But yes, I think you have a point there. And certainly, I don't think that legislative history is something that we should just lazily say we don't need to look at. But I'm cautious about it, because judges could also disagree about what the context meant those many years ago.
Justice?
Yeah, I just think you're right. What you need to do is look at what those words meant to the lawmakers who enacted the law. That's what's important. In fact, this is in constitutional interpretation, but I encountered this when looking at our state constitution. There's a wonderful clause that says monopolies are against the genius of a free state, shall not be allowed. And when I was looking into it, I realized what a monopoly means. You know, we all sort of know what that means today. I think even children understand it, you know, because if you're playing Monopoly and you manage to land on Boardwalk and Park Place at the same time, whoever else comes around to those squares is going to have to pay a lot of money, right, to stay there. So we have this sense of, oh, you dominate the market. But it turns out the word monopoly in 1776 in our first constitution, it meant something different to the people of our state then. And I think that's the sort of thing you do need to always check into that and understand that principle, because it's what the people who wrote the law understood those words to mean that matters.
All right, next question for Judge Inman first. Supreme Court races are partisan, as we've noted already today. You're a registered Democrat. You're the Democratic nominee for the seat. What should voters take away from that piece of information about you, if anything?
What they should take away from that first is that, as you know, the legislature made these races partisan in 2015. There may be some judges who asked for that. I don't know of any. And in order to now run for judge, if you do not identify as a Democrat or a Republican, you have to overcome a significant barrier to entry in the marketplace by getting petitions signed, names signed on a petition. So what people should take away from that is that I have identified as a Democrat, and I'm a lifelong Democrat. And I don't believe anything more than that. When I ran in 2014 and again in 2022, but more so then, it was easier, I was proud to have the support of many respected retired judges and lawyers who were Republicans. Since the law has changed to make these races partisan, people tend to see that label, and I think that it's unfortunate because I'm a person, not a partisan.
Judge Dietz, same question. You're the Republican nominee. What should voters take away from that, if anything, from your partisan identification?
Yeah, I actually think there's not much to take away from that. I think the idea is if we're doing our jobs as judicial candidates, we have a message about what we're going to bring to the court, and that's what voters need to look at. And I think when you ask people, overwhelmingly, I hear the idea that the public wants nonpartisan judges. But what they mean by that is we don't want judges involved in partisan politics. We think of judges as people that are outside politics, and they're right. That's what judges should be. And so I think part of the challenge is I hear a lot of people that are focused on this idea that the party labels are back on the ballot and as a reason to engage in sort of partisan politicking in running judicial campaigns. I think we need to do the opposite. We need to rise above that and say it's not about a party label. It's about what we do as judges. And what we do is focus on judicial independence and the idea that we have a message about, first of all, being able to decide cases fairly, to be impartial and uphold the law. And then second, about how we can be leaders in the courtroom and beyond the courtroom in the other things that the public really cares about. For example, one thing I hear from the public a lot is how expensive it is to get legal help. And that's something that that we can be leaders on as members of the judiciary and help find solutions. And I think when the public says, that's a judge working on these things that I care about, that's why they want to vote for that judge. And I think that's what matters and not the partisan politics.
All right, I got one final question for you two, and that is, what court opinion that you have written, or perhaps just an opinion that you didn't write but admire, is the best representation of your judicial philosophy and your approach to jurisprudence?
Gosh, so many. It's like asking someone to pick their favorite child, you know. Well, one opinion that comes to mind was called the State Board of Education versus the North Carolina Rules Review Commission. And this was a constitutional case of first impression in which the State Board of Education asserted that because it had been identified as an entity in our state constitution starting in 1868, and that in the first version of the Constitution it said shall legislate for what is right for schools, that the Rules Review Commission, which is part of the Administrative Procedures Act, and will say to the Board of Education, you want to have a rule, you don't get to just make it. We have to review it. Sometimes that review would take a while. This was very frustrating. And the Board of Education said, the legislature does not have the authority to hold up our rulemaking because we're an independent and foundational part of this state. After a lot of historical research about our Constitution from 1868 and then in the 30s and then in the 70s, I came to the conclusion that the Constitution had changed so that the word legislate had been removed from the description of what the Board of Education could do, and therefore the legislature of North Carolina did have the authority to require the rules that were made by the Board of Education to be approved by the Rules Review Commission. It was a fascinating case to work on because of all the historical research. And at the same time, just those simple, the word legislate is taken out, was also a reminder that if you just look at text, and I can think of all sorts of policy reasons why the Board of Education was very frustrated, but that's not something that I could decide. That's something that's in our Constitution and for our legislature to decide.
Judge Dietz.
So one case I know there were, some scholars have written about that as an example of the way that I approach constitutional interpretation is called Common Cause versus Forrest. And it was a fascinating case because it was about some legislation that was enacted by our General Assembly in a special session, and it happened very quickly over the course of, I think, just 48 hours. And so the question was about, there's a provision from our original Constitution in 1776 that guarantees the right of the people to instruct their representatives. And so this was actually the case, this was just 2 years ago, but it was the first time from 1776 till 2020 that the courts had ever examined what does this language mean. And my approach to it was to say, well, we start with the idea of we focus on the concept of we the people. So I'm looking at when this provision was added into our state constitution, you know, what did it mean then? And we traced it through from 1776 all the way to our third constitution in 1971, and ultimately concluded, if you look at where it was located, along with two other protections for the right to assemble and the right to petition the government, and we said what this right to instruct meant is open access to the legislative process. So our lawmakers can't do things in secret. They have to tell you that they're getting together to pass laws, and there has to be an opportunity for you to communicate with your legislators about what's going on. And we looked at the record in the case and said, well, that happened because everybody knew there was a special session. In fact, there were protests and there was a lot of media coverage and the opportunity for people to communicate with their legislators about whether they opposed or supported what our lawmakers were doing. And so we said, this satisfies what we think we the people intended when we said you have a right to instruct your representatives. Thank you.
So thank you to both of you. And now we're going to direct some questions towards Mr. Allen and Justice Ervin. And here's the first question for you. More and more, our society seems to be focused on whether something is deemed fair or just, not just whether it might be legal or illegal, constitutional or unconstitutional. Is it better for a judge to remain detached from the personal effects of a case, or is it better to express compassion to those affected? In other words, is it appropriate for a judge to try to right social injustices? And is that something that you would seek to do or have done on the court? Let's start with Mr. Allen, and then we'll go to Justice Ervin.
Thank you. So we traditionally portray Lady Justice as blindfolded. And I think that that image captures an important understanding about the limits of what courts can do. Courts are not equipped to right all of society's ills. They have to take issue by issue, case by case, party by party. What courts are charged with doing is providing justice, equal justice, under law. And that recognizes, that phrase, that under law part is very important because it recognizes that there is a limit on the authority of courts when they have to decide a matter. Of course, a judge is a human being, and a judge is going to have compassion for people who are in difficult circumstances. But for our system of government to function in the way it's supposed to, if we're to be faithful to those fundamental principles that are mentioned in Article 1, Section 35, our judges have to resist the temptation to really abuse the power that they've been given to decide cases, to instead go out and write laws. What people are entitled to when they come to court is a judge who's going to treat them the same way that judge would treat another person in a case that involved the same facts, and not show favoritism based on race or wealth or religion or any other factor that's not relevant to the matter at hand. Because this is an imperfect world, our justice system is necessarily imperfect. Our founders believed that the closest our courts can get to justice is a system in which the law is applied equally to everyone.
Justice Ervin.
My father was a state superior court judge and a judge of the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit for almost 20 years. He was about 13 years on the Superior Court. He used to say to me and to my brother that judges did not have what he described as a, quote, roving commission to do justice. At first blush, that sounds kind of strange to lots of people, but what he meant by that was that we don't have the responsibility for righting all societal wrongs. That is not the job of a court. I don't think that anybody with a law license pretends to the contrary. And therefore, the answer, specific answer to your question is the same one from me that Mr. Allen gave, which is we are a court of law. Our job is to make sure that the laws are applied equally to everybody. But he also went on to say something else. He said that it was important to understand the consequences of what one does as a judge. And the reason that it was important to understand those consequences was not because you should make a decision based upon your emotional reaction to the circumstances that a particular litigant found themselves in. Instead, what he continually reminded me was that we are engaged in a very, very, very serious business. That what we do has significant impact on the lives of the people whose cases come before us for decision. And so while it is not appropriate to take the circumstances that a person finds themselves in and then make a decision to try to arrive at some abstract, just outcome, it is important to understand what circumstances the litigants find themselves in because we need to take what we do very, very, very seriously. And one way to do that is to remember and remember and remember and remember that what we do has consequences, it has real effects on the lives of real people, and that we had better take our job seriously.
All right, the next question will go to you first, Justice Ervin. How would you describe your view on stare decisis? What rules guide your decision on when to override an established precedent?
Well, obviously, as a common law jurisdiction, North Carolina adheres to the doctrine of stare decisis, and there's very good reason for that. We have laws so that people will understand what conduct they can engage in without running afoul of the legal sanction. And so, therefore, if the law is unclear, then people are fundamentally uncertain about what they can or can't do. And such uncertainty is inimical to the ability of people to live their lives, particularly in a complex society like ours. I think I learned this lesson when I was on the Utilities Commission probably most thoroughly, because in many instances, what the business leaders who were involved in those cases would say sometimes was it didn't matter so much what the decision was. What mattered was, first of all, that it was clear, and secondly, that it was applied consistently. Because if you had a clear decision that was consistently applied, you could know what you were supposed to do. So stare decisis is a really, really important doctrine. My grandfather, when he was on the state Supreme Court, wrote a decision called State versus Balance, which I think is still perhaps the best discussion of this question of any decision that the court's handed down. And he said, in effect, first of all, that no decision is graven in stone to the extent that it can never be looked at again, but that you need to adhere to stare decisis in all but the most extraordinary circumstances for the reason that I just said. But he also had a line in there that said something like that there is no virtue against sinning against the light, and that therefore you had to, on occasion, consider, and he did in that case consider, whether a former or earlier case ought to be overruled, and did so. But he said that that should only be done in very, very clear instances, and only in the event that the court was convinced that it was wrong, and it also needed to take into consideration what would be the effect of a change in the law upon the rights, responsibilities, and obligations that people had to each other. So stare decisis is really important. You need to adhere to it in all but the most unusual circumstances, and if you decide that you are not going to follow a particular decision, you'd better have a really good reason for doing it.
Same question, Mr. Allen.
So there's no rule of law without stability in the law. And stare decisis is a very important doctrine that promotes stability in the law and therefore the rule of law. I do think that the extent to which or the degree to which stare decisis or the weight that it should be given depends in part on the kind of case that the court's considering. Stare decisis, I think, is at its strongest when you're talking about a common law precedent or a court's interpretation of a statute. And the reason that it's strongest in the case of a court's interpretation of a statute is because if the court gets it wrong, well, the legislature can pretty easily fix that and let the court know it was wrong through amending the law. Stare decisis is also very important in the context of constitutional law cases, But I think our courts have been a little more willing to re-examine constitutional law precedents precisely because if the court gets it wrong in a case involving a constitutional issue, there's no easy way to fix that. That's not something the legislature can remedy in the next session. So I would go on to say that when you're considering or when a court's considering whether to overturn a precedent, I think it should look at factors including the quality of the reasoning in the decision at issue. Is it persuasive? The workability of that case, is it still something that makes sense to apply in what are perhaps changed circumstances? And then reliance. To what extent have people, businesses, governments ordered their actions based on that prior case?
All right, this next question will start with you, Mr. Allen. What court opinion from the North Carolina Supreme Court or the United States Supreme Court is a good representation of your judicial philosophy and potential approach to jurisprudence?
I'm very partial to a case that many of you will have heard of, Baird v. Singleton. That's the case that established the principle of judicial review in North Carolina, that our courts, when presented with a clear conflict between our state constitution and a law passed by the legislature, have to follow the Constitution. That case was issued at more than 10 years before Marbury versus Madison. And there's an argument about whether we were, in fact, the first state to have a court that acknowledged the power of judicial review. So there's the historic nature of it, the fact that it provides that our courts or recognizes our court's obligation to follow the Constitution. But then I love the way that the judges in Baird approached what they did. They were presented with a clear conflict. Now, of course, I'm sure pretty much everybody here knows that there is no real equivalent in English courts to judicial review. English courts don't have the authority to invalidate acts of Parliament. So that was the tradition, you know, that our founders knew about. So this was a revolutionary change for our courts. And you see when you look at the case that the judges, knowing that if the case went forward, they'd have to invalidate an act of the legislature and recognizing what a tremendous step that is because acts of the legislature are taken to reflect the will of the people, they first tried to get the parties, if I remember correctly, it's been a long time since I read the case, but they first tried to get the parties basically to settle. Can't you guys go settle this so we don't have to decide the issue? And it was only when that didn't work that the court went on to pronounce the act of the legislature invalid. But the story doesn't end there. What was at issue in that case was a state law that set up a commission that allowed commission members to seize property that had belonged to loyalists in the Revolutionary War and then give that property to other folks. Well, there was no right under that legislation to a trial, but our state constitution provided for a jury, the right to a jury trial in cases involving property. So what the court then did, it ruled that the plaintiff had the right to a trial, but then it instructed the jury that, well, we have to give a trial here, but because these folks are aliens at that time anyway under common law, they didn't have the right to own property in North Carolina. So the instruction to the jury ensured that there was an outcome consistent with what the legislature wanted. And then if you read on to the end of the case, I believe it says that all the other plaintiffs took dismissals. So why do I say all that, and I'm sorry for going on? It just shows that our courts realized, even at the birth of judicial review, that it's a really big deal to strike down an act of the legislature because it represents the will of the people, and our courts should only do that in exceptional circumstances when there's no other option.
Justice Ervin.
In having written opinions for the Court of Appeals and for the Supreme Court for 13 years approximately, it's hard to pick one that I think exemplifies the kind of approach that I've taken to cases, but the one that has occurred to me as I was sitting here was a case called the City of Asheville versus the State. That was a case in which the General Assembly passed a statute that essentially divested the City of Asheville of its water and sewer system. That statute was challenged by the city on the grounds that it violated a provision of the state constitution that, as I recall, provided that the General Assembly did not have the authority to enact local legislation on the basis of that affected, as I recall it, health, sanitation, or the abatement of nuisances. And so the issue was whether this statute was, first, a piece of local legislation at all, and then, secondly, if it was, whether it affected health, sanitation, and the abatement of nuisances. The court had had a century, nearly, of pretty confusing decisions about what was and was not prohibited by that particular provision. In addition, this statute was written in such a way that it ostensibly applied statewide, but as a matter of fact, could not have applied anywhere other than to the City of Asheville. And so the opinion that I wrote was one of my traditionally fairly detailed opinions, in which I first dealt with the question of whether this was a piece of local legislation and concluded that it was, because whether something was a piece of local legislation or not depended really upon what it did rather than the label that was put on it. And then secondly, analyzed all of the cases that had dealt with whether something affected health, sanitation, or the abatement of nuisances, and tried to deduce some rule that had not previously been stated in those cases so that there would be a little bit more clarity going forward for everybody involved, and concluded that water and sewer service was quintessentially something that involved health and sanitation. Almost by definition, sewer service involves sanitation. It's hard to see how you have health without adequate water supplies, and therefore held that the statute in question was unconstitutional. Now, I agree that you don't strike down legislation unless you absolutely have to. The standard in North Carolina is that a statute has to be unconstitutional beyond a reasonable doubt before you strike it down. But I would point you to the analysis that was used in that case as an exemplar of how I try to analyze complicated case issues like the ones that appeared in that case. There are probably others that might better exemplify what I do, but that's one that occurs to me as I'm sitting here.
And I note that it took all the way to 45 minutes into our debate for someone to mention sewage. So
debates. I didn't know you wanted to do it earlier.
Well, you know. All right. So now we're going to move into the audience participation part of our show. And I want to thank you very much for those of you who submitted some questions. And I particularly want to appreciate your penmanship. Because if I now flub this question, it will be entirely my fault. So this is going to be a question for all four of you. And let's start with Judge Inman. When should the Supreme Court bypass review of the Court of Appeals? What would multiple bypasses of the Court of Appeals signal about the role of the Court of Appeals? Directed to a judge on the Court of Appeals.
Absolutely. Well, the Supreme Court has the discretion to bypass the Court of Appeals. It doesn't do it that often. The circumstances in which I think would or the factors that would perhaps justify the Supreme Court doing that. If there were a question of tremendous importance that also was on an extremely short timeline, where you're going to have circumstances that irreparable harm is going to be done to one side or the other if this isn't resolved in the next 6 months, that would be a reason that the Supreme Court could bypass the Court of Appeals. Of course, every litigant probably thinks their case needs to be decided in the next 6 months. So it's really up to the justices on the Supreme Court to think about that. I think that when the Supreme Court bypasses many cases and takes them from the Court of Appeals, it suggests to me that the Supreme Court doesn't have enough of a workload because they're taking more cases. It suggests to me that the Supreme Court doesn't think that the case could be resolved at the Court of Appeals, and I don't think that's a good enough reason to bypass the Court of Appeals. But I do think when you have some tremendously important, especially state constitutional issues or other issues that are on a short time frame, I think of election law, because we're going to have an election, and if there's a dispute and you need to get it resolved before the election, that would be a reason to do it more quickly. Business court cases used to come to the Court of Appeals. I miss those cases. They now go to the Supreme Court because of our legislature. And the one challenge of that is normally the Court of Appeals is dealing with a trial court record. We are dealing with all of, we're an error correcting court. We're looking at transcripts. We're looking at those details. The benefit that the Supreme Court gets when the Court of Appeals looks at a case first is that we've really done a lot of the spade work. And I think it narrows the work that the Supreme Court needs to do.
All right. Judge Dietz.
Yeah, I think there's one compelling reason for the Supreme Court to step in and take a case out of the hands of the Court of Appeals, and that's when it's a case that clearly would be one that the Supreme Court ultimately will hear. So it's a case that once decided by the Court of Appeals would satisfy the criteria for the Supreme Court to take it. And there's some very strong reason why the case needs to be decided and reach final judgment quickly. And I think that's the only reason. And so one thing I'll disagree a bit with Judge Inman about is I think our current Supreme Court is taking cases from the Court of Appeals at an unprecedented rate and not the kinds of cases that I just described that need to be heard. And in fact, I don't think the court is taking them because they're not busy enough. There are a lot of very important cases in the Court of Appeals where we have conflicts in our case law that we can't resolve because only the Supreme Court, when we have these conflicting judgments, can step in and say, here's what the law should be. And those cases, I think, are important and should be resolved. They're not taking those cases. And we have many cases, for example, where there's criminal defendants, and we've upheld a criminal judgment. So this is someone who's been deprived of their liberty, and they're in prison. And they have petitioned the Supreme Court to hear the case. And the Supreme Court is not expediting those cases, where it's possible that somebody is in prison and should not be in prison and had their liberty taken away by the state. And instead, they've focused on taking cases that seem to have a political dimension. And I think that's part of what's harming the integrity of our courts right now, is that that appears to be political. And again, part of the message that I have for the public is I'm going to steer our Supreme Court away from that kind of thing and get it back to its core role of creating the stable body of jurisprudence so that people can know the law and they can resolve their legal disputes fairly. And I think when we look at it from that context, it should be a very, very rare scenario where the Supreme Court would ever reach down and take a case away from the Court of Appeals.
Mr. Allen.
I agree with Judge Dietz. I would add that as I've gone around the state campaigning, I have heard many people talk about the way the Supreme Court has been pulling up cases when there's not a clear reason to do so. And many people have suggested that that action, or have said that that action appears to be related to the fact that we have an election coming up. And I think that's unfortunate. I think it makes the court look more like a political body than a court of law.
And Justice Ervin.
Well, I'm somewhat handicapped in answering this question by the Code of Judicial Conduct. It prohibits me from commenting upon cases that are pending before the court. And so my response to this question has to be considerably circumscribed. I would say as a general matter, when I have to vote on whether to allow bypass petitions, the things that come into my mind are the things that are set out in the statute. After all, there is a statute that specifies circumstances under when this can and cannot be done. And the factors that I think of and that I think are set forth in the statute are some of the ones that my colleagues down the table have alluded to in the past. Is this an important case? Is this one that will have substantial public importance? Secondly, is this a case that is likely to wind up in front of the Supreme Court anyway? Thirdly, is there a need for expedition? Now, I would agree that generally speaking, justice delayed is justice denied, and that there's always things that the courts can do to move cases along more rapidly than they do. But there are cases that clearly call for resolution in an expeditious fashion. And I think those are the types of cases that ought to be the subject of allowed bypass motions. I don't think I can comment any further with respect to the other statements that have been made, except that I would challenge anyone to look at my record, and you can find instances in which I have voted in ways that would not be perceived to be what one would expect given my political position. You can take a look at that, see what you think, and you can make your own evaluation about how I have conducted myself as a member of the Supreme Court.
All right, I'm going to try to work in one more question before we go to our closing statement, so try to keep these responses concise. I know you are lawyers, but let's try. All right, so is there a provision of the North Carolina Constitution which you believe is more protective than the equivalent federal provision? You don't have to actually think it should be more protective, but just give me an example of a protection of a right or procedure in the North Carolina Constitution that is stronger than the comparable federal protection. Start with Justice Ervin.
Well, there are a number of instances in which the court has done exactly that. So that's not really a question of, you know, what I think. It's a question of what the court has held. Historically, if you look at some of the court's substantive due process cases involving economic issues, there are suggestions that the degree of protection provided under the law of the land clause may be more substantial than that provided under substantive due process at the federal level. Another example in the criminal context is the decision that the court made a generation ago to decline to hold under Article 1, Section 20 of the North Carolina Constitution that the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule applied. The court specifically held that in North Carolina it did not, therefore providing greater protection against unlawful searches and seizures than was provided under federal law. So there are specific instances in which that's already been done.
Mr. Allen.
We have certainly some rights in our state constitution that don't even appear in the federal constitution. And we have recently, or the people of this, well, I can't comment probably any further on that because it concerns some issues that are going to probably come before the court in the near future. So I'll leave it at that. Thanks.
Okay. Judge Dietz.
Yeah, I think in law school we all study the Lochner era and the idea that there were these protections of economic liberty in the due process clause that have been reduced to what we now call just rational basis. You know, is it rational what the government was doing? And we do have much stronger protections in the North Carolina Constitution in that similar realm of economic liberty. It comes not just from the law of the land clause, but another bundle of rights that I know you all heard some about earlier in a previous segment, the Fruits of Their Own Labor Clause, the Monopolies Clause, the Exclusive Emoluments Clause, the Just and Equitable Tax Clause. So I think what's remarkable about this, our state constitution, is how our framers both use some of the similar language that's in the U.S. Constitution, but also have these wonderful special rights that are, you know, sort of part of the spirit of North Carolina that only we have here in our state.
Judge Inman.
The Fruits of Their Labor Clause is particularly interesting to me because I worked on authored an opinion in Mole versus the City of Durham recently about that. And interestingly, the Fruits of Their Labor Clause was added into our Constitution in 1868. And if you look at legislative history, if you look at what the framers were talking about, that was a rare time in North Carolina in Reconstruction when the legislature voted to put to the people to amend the Constitution to make sure that formerly enslaved people knew that they could not be required to work for free and that no one would expect that a formerly enslaved person would work for free. but that indeed has given rise to these economic rights. And it's important that we look at provisions like, and then when you consider it with other provisions in the state constitution, it's important not to say this is going to be in lockstep with what the federal constitution would do in these cases, because it's under the North Carolina state constitution.
Well, thank you very much for your audience submissions, and we are now ready to proceed to closing statements, and we will start with you, Judge Inman.
I am so lucky to be sitting right next to you.
I hear that all the time.
Well, in closing, I will just say I wish that we had more time together because this is such an impressive group, and I know that you all understand the issues in these judicial elections more than many, many other people. It's the privilege of my life to have served as a Superior Court judge and to serve on the North Carolina Court of Appeals. I'm at the end of my term, and I believe that my experience has prepared me to fairly and impartially consider the hardest and the most hard-fought cases that are decided by our Supreme Court. Partisan politics does threaten the independence of our judiciary and the public's perception of that. And I'm going back to the Board of Education case that I talked about. That was a split decision from the Court of Appeals. I don't remember the entire panel, but I think Judge John Tyson, who's here, dissented from my majority opinion, and it went across the street to the Supreme Court. There was a split decision, and in the dissent were Chief Justice Martin and Justice Robin Hudson. We were dividing not along party lines on very, very important constitutional cases. And it's very troubling to me when we see that the Supreme Court, especially in the year of 2021, had so many cases of all matters that weren't even political, where you had a 4-3 decision. I think that a pattern of judges and justices voting together in lockstep suggests that they are not acting as independently as they need to be. I have a record of collaborating with my colleagues, of dissenting when I believe that they have misstated the law. I think that's an important role. And if you look at my record, I think you will see that I am prepared to collaborate, but also to honestly discuss differences and to help make decisions that find common ground narrowly rather than making radical change, so that we can have the stability that our democracy requires of our Supreme Court. Thank you.
Judge Dietz.
It's been one of the honors of my life to serve for the last 8 years on the Court of Appeals, and I am so proud of North Carolina's justice system and so proud of all the people that work in our court system. And I truly believe that North Carolina is a model for how the rule of law can keep a society safe and help everyone grow and prosper together. And I think throughout our history, the North Carolina Supreme Court has been a central part of that success. And I'm running for Supreme Court because I want to keep it that way. And I think our Supreme Court needs leaders who can reassure the public that the judicial branch, the courts are independent, that the courts are not involved in politics, and that the judge's role is to defend our constitutional rights, to protect the rule of law, and to help people resolve their legal disputes fairly. And that's it. And I can be that leader for the North Carolina Supreme Court, and that's why I'm running. And I would just ask you all, when you go to vote in November, to vote for Judge Richard Dietz for Supreme Court. And thank you all, and thank you for believing in me in this journey to our state's highest court.
Mr. Allen.
One of the first questions that we heard involved Article 1, Section 5, a frequent recurrence to fundamental principles is absolutely necessary to preserve the blessings of liberty. I want to focus for just a moment on that word necessary. That means if you don't do it, we lose our liberty. One of the fundamental principles that our Constitution lays out is separation of powers. Why is that so vital? Well, more than any other branch of government, the judiciary depends for its authority on the public trust. If the people don't believe, if we get to the point where a critical mass of the public has no longer believes that our courts function as courts of law and instead function as political bodies, as super legislatures, we'll lose our justice system. I'm running because I don't want that to happen. I agree that we have a model system that was given to us by our founders and preserved by so many judges and lawyers who've gone before us. But there's no guarantee that we keep that. We have to renew our commitment to those values with every generation. And so I'm running for the North Carolina Supreme Court to do what I can to increase the public's faith in our state's highest court as a body where decisions, especially in politically charged cases, are being made by justices who are basing their decisions on the law and the facts and leaving their personal preferences at the door. I ask for your support in this race. Again, I'm Trey Allen, and thank you so much for taking your time to listen to us today.
Justice Irvin.
And lastly, I want to echo Mr. Allen and my colleagues in thanking you for your attention this evening. These are very important races. Lawyers have outsized influence in these races, as you all know, because many people talk to you about what these races are, and so I appreciate you paying attention. I've talked a lot about my record because alone among the folks up here, I've got one on both courts. I think if you look at my record, you will see that I try to do and do what I described earlier. You can see analyses of voting patterns. I think if you look at those, you will see that I do not hesitate to take any particular party's side in a particular case because I think that party is correct. I think that's what the law requires, and therefore I do it. I've done that even in what can be described as politically charged cases on several different occasions. Ultimately, the success of a court depends upon the perception of the fairness and the impartiality of that court. All of us that are on this podium have been through a fairly lengthy campaign process already. I think most of us will probably be happy when it's over in a couple of months. But I can point to you as at least one piece of evidence that I can do the job fairly and impartially. I have the endorsement of both the Advocates for Justice and the Association of Defense Attorneys. These are folks who litigate against each other, but both of them have concluded that my record is one that they can have confidence in. I ask you to have confidence in that record as well. Again, I would appreciate very much having your support. Thank you for the attention that you've paid. Thank you for your interest in this forum. Mr. Moderator, thank you for your participation in it as well, even though we didn't talk about sanitation apparently as much as you would have liked. And again, it's been a great time to spend with you. Thank you very much.
All right, so I want to thank all of our panelists for sharing their ideas and thoughts with us, and let's give them all a round of applause.